You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Artist Rachel Sussman gives a great description of her project in the preface to her book. She says, "The oldest living things in the world spans disciplines, continents, and millennia. It is part art and part science, innately tied to the environment and underscored by an existential journey into deep time." So what is deep time? Do we all have an idea what we're talking about here? It's not the party that lasts 12 hours or the month-long retreat. It's not the 20 years you watch your kids grow up or even the pleasure of seeing your great-grandchildren. The concept of deep time dates back to the 18th century geologist James Hutton, who proposed that Earth was a lot older than 6,000 years, as most people thought at the time. Earth is roughly 4.5 billion years old, a figure rather difficult for us humans with our life expectancy of under 100 years to grasp. As writer John McPhee wrote, quote, "Numbers do not seem to work well in regard to deep time. Any number above a couple of thousand years, 50,000, 50 million, will, with nearly equal effect, awe the imagination." But artists can help us to imagine deep time, and that is one of the many really special rewards of Rachel Sussman's epic journey to photograph the oldest living things in the world. She sets off to photograph not just the oldest trees in the world, but ancient life across all species. She's a young woman who embraces awe, even taking the polar plunge, rite of passage, in the Antarctic on one of her many expeditions. She's a contemporary artist based in Brooklyn. Rachel is the recipient of many awards, including a 2014 Guggenheim, and her exhibition record spans more than a decade in museums and galleries in the U.S. and Europe. Her book, The Oldest Living Things in the World, was published by University of Chicago Press in 2014. And we're deeply honored tonight to have Ursula K. Heise, Marcia K. H. Howard Professor in the Department of English and the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA and a 2011 Guggenheim Fellow to be our interlocutor tonight. Ursula's new book, Imagining Extinction, The Cultural Meanings of Endangered Species, will be out later this year from University of Chicago Press. So please join me in welcoming Rachel Sussman, and we will all try to comprehend the meaning of deep time. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Thank you for braving the elements out there. So I'm just waiting for the slides to come up. I brought too many things than we have time for to share with you, so I might rush through a few things, but if you have questions, keep them in mind. So one of the first things I often get asked about the oldest living things is, how did I get the idea? Well, I'm going to start at the beginning, or maybe before the beginning. So back in 2004, I was invited to go to Japan with some friends, and I pretty much never turned down an invitation to travel. Good advice for everybody, I think. And I just completed an artist residency at the Cooper Union, and I had just bought a new medium format camera, which I still shoot with. That's 6.7. That's negatives are about yay big. And I was making a lot of work that dealt with the relationship between humanity and nature. And I went to Japan without an agenda, though, just sort of this general searching around these creative ideas. And I'd started thinking about wanting to work with science, to do an art and science project, as well as incorporate philosophical ideas about time. But these things weren't clear. This was a period of creative churn for me. I had this moment, though. I was in Kyoto, I was by myself, didn't speak the language, and had a moment where I felt uncomfortable. So I went to this place that was supposed to be so ancient, you know, the old temples and gardens, and you know, I pulled into the train station, and there's Starbucks and Kinko's, and I'm thinking, this isn't quite what I had in mind. And I had a moment where I thought, you know what, maybe I'm going to go home. That sort of this feeling of, I'm uncomfortable, I'm not sure why I'm here. And I had this little conversation with myself where I thought, you know, I could give myself permission to go home, and that's okay. But then I thought about something that a couple of different people had told me. They said, if you're interested in the relationship between humanity and nature, you have to go visit the 7,000-year-old tree. And I was like, okay, wait a second, that maybe is kind of cool. I might want to check that out. So I did that. I packed up and headed in the opposite direction of home. I went on a journey. And what would ensue would be this amazing travel experience that I just couldn't have planned or predicted. So, you know, it's a 3 or 4 hour ferry ride from the southernmost point of Kyushu to get to the island of Yakushima. Once you're on Yakushima, it's a 2-day hike to get to this tree. So there was some commitment involved. I'll have to make a long story short, but suffice it to say, I was befriended by some people on the ferry on the way over and had a place to stay and guides to the tree and this absolutely magical experience that ended up planting a kernel of this idea that combined with all of those other creative things that had been churning. So this idea of wanting to connect with nature, wanting to connect with these deep philosophical ideas, and wanting to connect with science. So it was over a year later when I got the idea for the oldest living things in the world. It just clicked. I was telling the story of my travel experience, and all of a sudden I understood how all of these things I was interested in could be completely interconnected in this beautiful way, where I would look for continuously living organisms that are 2,000 years old and older. So I think we'll certainly talk about deep time even a little bit more later. But the idea was to look at year zero and back, which is, why is it 2016 right now? So 2000 and back. You know, why isn't it 4,500,000,000 2016? I'm just saying. So I ran home that very night and started doing some research. This is the culmination of 10 years of work, so that wasn't a one-night project. Some other adventures ensued. This is me getting ready to make some images of the Siberian actinobacteria, which is the oldest known living thing on the planet. It's between 400,000 and 600,000 years old. So, yeah, to spare you the suspense, there's a fascinating story about each and every one of my subjects. We don't have time to go into it tonight. But this was discovered by a team of planetary biologists looking for clues to life on other planets by looking at some of the harshest conditions of life on Earth. I learned to scuba dive for the project. This is the 100,000-year-old seagrass meadow growing in the Balearic Islands in Spain. This is a clonal colony. That means that it's an interconnected root system. So it's not a single blade of grass that's 100,000 years old, but this is a single organism that's genetically the same today as it was 100,000 years ago. This, by the way, is more what I looked like on my first dive. So you don't start out as a pro. And I was photographing the 2,000-year-old brain coral there, which is an animal, by the way. So, you know, while I was doing the research for this project, I was learning things and remembering these little bits of information I'd learned as a kid in science class. And all of a sudden, it was brought to life in these really beautiful ways. This is me donning an Arctic safety suit up in Greenland. I was there to photograph these lichens that are around 3,000 years old. And this is my favorite statistic from the whole project, is the growth rate of these. They're called map lichens, or Rhizocarpon geographicum. They grow 1 centimeter every 100 years. So, I mean, it's so perfect because it's such a great way to encapsulate a human lifespan. So imagine if your life's work was to grow 1 centimeter. Continents are moving away faster than these lichens are growing. This is nearby where those lichens were photographed. So in the book and when I have exhibitions, I include images of landscapes that in some way, for me, this is like a landscape of a feeling, of a philosophical idea, of an emotion. You know, there's things that create context that simply seeing this lichen might not quite create. excuse me. Greenland for me was a really important and fascinating trip. One of the things that, which I will not get into, was getting lost alone in Greenland, which I don't recommend. This is not a crime scene, by the way. This is dinner. One of the things that visiting a place as remote as Greenland helped me realize is that there's places and experiences that can give you a window into a time frame that we don't usually have access to. So I was able that evening to fish in a stream full of hundreds of trout. So this is a good fish story. Hundreds of trout that there were so many, the people that I was camping with were able to pull them out of the stream with their bare hands. It's certainly a glimpse of what life was like before humans took over the planet. This is a Norse gravesite right by the lichens and the trout. They didn't make it. on the other side of the world, this is in Namibia. I was there photographing the Welwitschia plant. This is a primitive conifer. It's around 2,000 years old. Also a fascinating specimen. That's a baby one for context. The Yoretta plants, so these are shrubs that live in the Atacama Desert in Chile at about 15,000 feet elevation. You know, they sort of look a little alien. They're shrubs. They're made of hundreds of branches, very densely packed together with clusters of leaves at the end. And they're relatives of things like parsley and carrots. So there's a lot of humor infused sort of accidentally and, you know, going to the Atacama, parts of which are absolute desert, which have received no rainfall in all of recorded history, and yet going to find some 3,000-year-old parsley. Not really. There are some amazing, amazing tales of survival, as you can imagine. So certainly we can understand visiting the giant sequoias, ancient trees. There's this immediate sense of awe that just the physical presence of them. What you're looking at here are clippings of a 43,600-year-old shrub that is the only one of its kind left on the planet. So these clippings were propagated at the Botanic Garden in Hobart. So the original plant lives in Tasmania. It's critically endangered. Obviously, there's one left. And yet, it's theoretically immortal because it continues to clone itself. So there's this fascinating tension about these individuals that have survived long past their expected life expectancies, not just as an individual, but as a species. I mean, just a little scientific note. How do we know that this is 43,600 years old? Well, this was done with a combination of testing. You started with finding fossilized material from this plant, doing radiocarbon dating, and then doing genetic testing, cross-matching the living plant with the fossilized specimen, and finding it to be an exact match. So that's why we know this plant is at least 43,600 years old. But that really is just the age of the fossilized specimen. I'm going to speak about a few different images that connect with the environment. Obviously, environmental longevity, climate change, human impact are completely integral to the nature of this project. I should say, though, one of the things that I was trying to do as an artist is make portraits of these organisms, so to create a more personal connection. So if we're thinking of these organisms as individuals, the idea is to create a personal connection to these timescales that we otherwise wouldn't really have a sense of. But when you see that this spruce is 9,550 years old, living on this mountaintop plateau in Sweden, there's a chance to connect with it thinking about what it's seen in all those years. I do have a laser pointer. So you see here, there's this sort of scrubby mass of branches at the bottom. For the first 9,500 years of its life, that was as tall as this tree got. In the past 50 or so, this spindly trunk grew up in the center. And why is that? It got warmer. The climate zone actually changed at the top of this mountaintop plateau. So this also goes to show how we don't need to necessarily be standing right next to something to have an impact on it. There's no place on the planet that is not impacted by human activity. The same is true of the bristlecone pines. So California, by the way, is just spoiled with the number of old things. So well done, California. So the bristlecone pines are the oldest unitary organisms on the planet. But they're facing a number of threats now as well from a warming climate. So things like fungus and beetles that were kept at bay by the cold temperatures on these high mountaintops are now slowly making their way up and invading these trees. Some of the human impacts are much more direct. This is a tree, or was a tree, called the Senator that lived in Orlando, and it's a rather tragic tale of some kids who snuck into this park at night where the tree was protected. It was the original tourist attraction in Orlando, so BD, before Disney. People came in their horse and carriage to visit the Senator tree, until some kids decided to sneak in and do drugs inside the tree, because it was hollowed out in the center. And they lit it on fire from the inside out, and then they posted about it on Facebook. The only little kernel of hope in that story is that because this tree was old and well-studied, there were some clones of it planted in a nearby nursery, and they transplanted one back to the original site, and the community named it the Phoenix. So it is lovely to be able to connect in this personal way to these stories of these organisms. Unfortunately, this is another tragic one. The underground forest, luckily not the only one of its kind. This is a fascinating phenomena in and of itself. Certain species of trees and shrubs in the bushveld region of Africa, where it's prone to quite a lot of fires, came up with this rather ingenious way to protect themselves. They just moved everything underground. So when the fire comes through, it's just like getting a little singe off the top, and they can send up new shoots. This was around 13,000 years old, living outside the Botanic Garden in Pretoria, until it was bulldozed over to make way for a new roadway. Others are, this is in Tasmania, the Huon Pine. This was a forest fire, although it's connected to a living part of this colony that's 10,500 years old. I don't know if you all have seen recently, there was another very big forest fire in Tasmania where they lost some 1,000-year-old old-growth forest. That, by the way, and this as well, is on private property that are both mining sites. So there's a very interesting tension between protection and discovery. For instance, this very rare eucalyptus was discovered only because an environmental impact report was required by the mining for the mining to take place. What they found was this eucalyptus that's so rare, there's 3 or 4 individuals left in the world. And it's a little tricky to see. There's a little, There's a little orange fencing in the back there. So you can see how close and how connected these things are, that there is no safe place. Even at the ends of the earth, this is South Georgia Island. Anyone familiar with South Georgia and the Shackleton story? Anyone? A few? Got a few nods. I could speak all night about Shackleton, but I won't. This is an old whaling station in South Georgia Island that's out beyond, if you know the Antarctic Peninsula, South Georgia is just beyond it. So it's within the Antarctic convergence, but it's just a little bit warmer. So you have just this amazing abundance of life there. I was there finding some old moss, which it's a little difficult to see here, but if you see a little green on the slope, that is 5,500-year-old moss on Elephant Island, which is right around the corner from where Ernest Shackleton and his crew were marooned for, I believe it was over a year they were on the island, 2 years altogether. This is one of my favorite stories. It comes from the heroic age of Antarctic exploration about 100 years ago. The tenacity that it took for these men to survive in Antarctica for 2 years. Their ship sank before they hit land. You know, nobody was coming to get them. They're out there with basically wet sweaters and penguins and seals to eat. You know, this is some serious business. But they all survived. Not only that, but they came to their own rescue. So it's a little, I don't have enough time to go into that story in depth, but I was incredibly moved by that and found the connection between that kind of human story and the perseverance that these organisms show. There's this beautiful connection that you start to see. And in part, some of it's just written in the landscape. This is, again, back in South Georgia. It's one of my favorite places in the world. This is Medusa Kelp in Hercules Bay. it's another South Georgia. And then this is the moss that was right near that whaling station. Of course, the whaling just decimated the whale population, but also we have things like invasive species like rats and grasses, which are still being eradicated today from when they first appeared 100 years ago. This is Shackleton's grave. This is and an elephant seal guarding it. So this is the last image in the book, and this was my last big expedition of the project. How are we on time? I just wanted to. Okay, so I'm going to really speed through the next bits. I just wanted to share a little bit. These are some installation shots of a traveling exhibition. I wanted to show that I'm trying to have this combination of sharing the photographs as formal art pieces, then connecting in with the science a bit more. This is my Linnaean taxonomy of all of this of the subjects in my project, combined with four different images that represent the four kingdoms that are part of the project. And then I've handwritten on the wall the kingdoms. You'll notice if you see my photographs, I handwrite on each individual photograph as well. So that's a nod to scientific field notes. The titles have quite a lot of information in them. And I also create a research studio installation filled with what's basically the sort of messy underbelly of the project. So research papers, my x-ray of when I slipped and fell and broke my wrist in Sri Lanka trying to find the Sri Maha Bodhi tree. That was a bummer. And all my sketchbooks, these are just various installations. The point being that whether it's in the exhibition or in the book, what I'm trying to do is to create this connection to the not just the layers and silos of various subject matters that are tied together, but also this temporal layering. So you have all these different modes of time happening in the same moment. So you have the split second of a shutter. You have the 2,000 years it took for the subject to get there. Or is it 10,000? Or is it 500,000? And then somewhere in between, you have me clicking the shutter, you have you taking it in. And then all of a sudden, we have these vast eternities holding the same space with these instances that are all part of this fabric of a temporal whole. I think I'm going to run out of time, unfortunately, to share most of the rest with you, so I'm just going to zoom through. I just wanted to return to this lichen, because this has, in some ways, led me to what I'm working on now, which is an exploration of time and space. Some of these lichens were recently sent into space by astrobiologists who are studying the origins of life as potentially having existed outside of Earth and potentially piggybacked in on a meteorite, for instance. So these lichens were taken into space and exposed to outer space conditions for 10 days and returned completely healthy and intact. And the stromatolites, the oldest living stromatolites are in Western Australia. They're between 2,000 and 3,000 years old. But they're also one of the oldest known life forms that we know of that existed on Earth 3.5 billion years ago. So we're getting into some cosmic timescales here. The other fascinating thing that I learned through this research, the stromatolites are part biologic and part geologic, so they're living and non-living at the same time. And the biologic part, the cyanobacteria, performs photosynthesis. And photosynthesis, as we know, produces oxygen. So the next time you take a breath, you can thank the stromatolites for spending 900 million years oxygenating our planet. I guess we'll have to zoom through. This is at NASA Ames. That's a microbial mat of cyanobacteria. So starting to see this connection of time and space. That's the surface of the astrobiology building. These are shavings in the NASA Ames machine shop floor of things that didn't quite make it to space, but ended up rather space-like. The painting I've been working on. I'm afraid I'll just zoom through, although I'll have to stop here. This is the at NASA JPL in your backyard, the Mars Yard. This is the tread of the Mars rover. If you see here, there's this little differentiation in the pattern. In order to determine when something's so far away that it's made a full revolution of the wheels, they had to create a different marking in the pattern of the tread so we could visualize. Again, this goes with so many interesting things about figuring out how the visual connects with the way we perceive things. At any rate, the first version said JPL in the tread. And the rest of NASA was like, we don't want JPL printed all over the surface of Mars. Like, that's not cool, guys. So they said, okay, we'll change it. That says JPL in Morse code. we'll save this for another talk. That's the theory of relativity that I just made in Krypton. This is another project which we don't have time for. And I'll just wrap up with talking about an idea that I have at CERN. This is at CERN. It's a couple of different experiments there. I had the pleasure of being a visiting artist at CERN, speaking with scientists. So through the course of Oldest Living Things, obviously, I got to speak with scientists all over the world. While I was at CERN, I thought, I want to connect with this idea about the nature of the universe, the very beginnings of the universe, the Big Bang. This is what's happening, fundamental physics. But I can't just bother the scientists all day and interfere with their research. So I had this idea of creating a permanent installation that would be a physical walk around the collider loop, but above ground. It's 17 miles around. And I thought, wouldn't it be fascinating if that represented all of time? And it would start at the experiment looking at the few seconds after the Big Bang. You go one direction, it's the Big Bang. You go the other direction, it's now. You go the Big Bang route. You're walking for over 9 billion years before Earth even exists. So again, it's just this idea of connecting to deep time, to making something personal that is so impersonal. What is a singularity of infinite density. Stephen Hawking was onto something. I'm not sure if I quite knew, but the message is, dare mighty things. Thank you. Sorry, I hope I didn't go on.
Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome.
That was great. And I'm sure we'd all love to hear more about the future projects. But
next time,
let's maybe stick with this one. So, really enjoyed reading your book and looking at the photos, and that's a big part of this book. It's a multimedia book that consists of text and pictures. So it's good to have some of them here, and we'll come back, I hope, to some of these really striking photographs. But I wanted to start by asking you a couple of somewhat more general things. So you mentioned in your book, and you just mentioned in your talk a couple of times how important it is to you to create for your readers a personal connection to almost unimaginably long time span. So this deep time that Louise also mentioned. And so, you know, as a college professor, I feel elated about this. And at the same time, I think, man, I deal all the time in class with kids who, you know, have a hard time telling me when the Civil War was or California statehood, let alone like Mexican independence and, you know, the Cuban Revolution, you know, all things that are pretty important for culture and politics. So why should we bother with these long time spans when there's so much shorter but much more immediately relevant human history to deal with?
Oh, I just don't think they're mutually exclusive. That's the, I mean, I think, you know, it's funny when you're talking about your students, it makes me think of myself as a student, as a kid. I had no aptitude for remembering dates of things. There was just no relationship there. I didn't know why I was supposed to care about it. I didn't take it in. I didn't internalize it. And that's exactly why I bring up the personal connection. As soon as something starts to have personal relevance to you, then there's absolutely a reason for you to internalize it. So I think a lot of that has to do with the framing. And that's one of the values of being an artist, coming into things that, while dealing with factual information, there's a different kind of mandate, if there is a mandate to begin with. You have all this leeway. Like, I could create the parameters that I wanted to work in, which are different than what a scientist is, the parameters that a scientist or a historian or any other discipline is required to work in. So the beauty of it is starting with an idea and staying connected to it is a way to then communicate that idea across disciplines. Instead of in a particular way, rote memorization and regurgitation, it's more about seeing whatever entry point. I mean, this is the thing, as you can tell when I'm giving a talk, I could talk to you for hours because there's so many different things to talk about. The beauty of that is there's all these different entry points into the work. Mm-hmm. So it could be visually through a photograph. It could be through the scientific papers. It could be through travel. It could be from some weird, quirky souvenir that I've collected in some remote place that you think, oh, that reminds me of something I once saw. So the beauty of it is that it's wide open.
And so in thinking about these organisms, do you want the impact of it to be intellectual and cognitive? So for us as your readers to think about things like what has now come to be called the Anthropocene, so the idea that actually we no longer live in the geological epoch called the Holocene, but that because of the pervasive human impact on the Earth's ecology, we now really live in an age that should be named after humans. So is that, and we need to think in these geological ages, or is there something much more personal? Is there, and I found that both sort of exalting and depressing about the book, that on one hand it was amazing, you know, this sort of feeling of limitlessness, being free of constraints and thinking about something that's half a million years old. But then you come back to your own life and you know it's only going to be like 70 or 90 or, if you're really lucky, 100 years, and you're all depressed. You can never measure up to these actinobacteria or the stromatolites. You know, they're all going to outstrip you. But at which level do you see the impact of your work? Is it that sort of cognitive engaging with a changing conception of how humans inhabit time, or is it sort of more thinking about our own lifespan and mortality?
Yes.
No, you can't. No. This is a war question. You can't answer
it. I know, but it is, yes, it is both of those things. I mean, I can break this down into several different components. I mean, when we think about climate change and then just the fact that we are in the Anthropocene, this is another instance where...
Oh, we don't know yet. The geologists actually haven't decided yet whether we are or not, but...
I won't jump
the
gun.
No, it doesn't matter at this point what they... Everybody thinks we are in the Anthropocene.
Well, one of the things that has been a challenge, I think, in understanding that climate change is happening, we hear these dry figures and we can't relate to them. So we pass 400 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere and people's eyes glaze over. You know, there's not, where's the personal entry point into that? I don't understand that. I don't feel that. Whereas the image of the spruce tree, for instance, I show you, here's this tree that's been there for 9,500 years. And then in 50 years, you can visually see how an impact has been made. And it's in this remote place. There's not somebody standing next to it with space heaters making it grow faster. I mean, it's a way to connect with, wow, that life has been there and that life is being impacted. So I think in that example, it's functioning on both levels. So it is factual. It is about information, but it is about creating a way into something that also isn't saying, you know, shame on you for all the things that you do that have contributed to climate change. It's not about shaming. It's about saying, oh, wait a second. I am part of this. I now understand this a little bit more. And hopefully that will lead to some positive changes in behavior. Yeah.
But so that's a really interesting tension. And I noticed that a little bit in your book, but it was a lot more obvious, I think, in your talk just now, that on one hand, you emphasize the danger of extinction, which is something that I'm really, really interested in the way we think about the passing of life forms. But on the other hand, the gist of your book doesn't seem to be what we're most worried about with climate change now, which is that it might drive a lot of species into extinction. The gist of the book seems to be more, look, there's actually organisms that can survive practically no matter what. You know, they have made it through ice ages. I mean, things that are 80,000 years old or even 13,000 years old, you know, have made it through ice ages, have made it through all kinds of adversities. So isn't
but yet are endangered just, now, though. So even...
But we don't know. Right.
Well, except for a number of them, we actually do know. So things like the 80,000-year-old clonal colony of aspen trees, Pando, which has survived for so long. It's so, I mean, it's also so resilient. Like the colony moves towards better nutrient availability. It moves towards higher elevations. I mean, this is obviously at an incredibly slow pace, but it's now being outrun by the speed of climate change. So likewise with the bristlecone pine. So I definitely thought it was important to mention in every instance, here is a specific way where climate change, we can see the impact. But you also are right that the point of it isn't that here's this giant cautionary tale. Instead, it's nuanced.
Right, just I didn't like get that sense. It's actually refreshingly different from a lot of environmental books in that.
And that was important for me because the central theme of the project was longevity and to think about time. And everything else I included was in service of that, to that idea. Right. The environmental aspects are absolutely vital and important, but at the same time, it wasn't meant to be a way to scold everybody. It wasn't meant to say, the idea is that there is this beautiful resilience and connection and interconnection that still exists on our planet. And my hope is that these things can then serve as beacons of hope, as some connecting factor of across continents, across nations, that they belong to all of us, but also require our protection. So longevity and immortality are not the same thing.
So if I could press you a little bit on that. So that totally makes sense to me. And I think that was sort of, that's the really great tone of the book, is that it brings up these issues, but without being quite as dire as environmental films and books can sometimes be. On the other hand, when you start thinking about really long timeframes. I mean, to put it with Mark Twain, well, in the long run, we're all dead, right? And that is true of species as well. I mean, species have an average run of 10 million. Some taxa, like dinosaurs, had a lot longer than that. But eventually, I mean, 99-point-something% of life forms that have ever existed on the Earth are gone. So isn't there a sense in which looking at very long time spans can actually diminish the significance of something that's going on now, like climate change, where you say, well, over the long run, this might just be a blip. So do you see that as a tension?
It's a very interesting point, and certainly one that I've been asked about. The thing is that the pace of climate change right now is like nothing we've ever seen. Right. And these organisms are remarkable because they're able to adapt, but they can't adapt this fast. And so that is the absolutely key and vital difference. You can take the philosophical view that it's all natural. We're natural. We're part of nature. I'm not subscribing to that philosophy. I'm saying, you know, we are creating this and we are having a negative direct impact that we can visually see. So my hope is that there's a way to see that.
I want to come back later to the point about adaptation, but let me ask you something else about you mentioned that you wanted to do portraits of these organisms, which I think is a really interesting term, so as to create a personal connection. And I was wondering what for you is the difference between these kinds of mosses, lichens, bacteria, trees, animals in the case of the coral, and geological artifacts, because I was sort of found myself thinking as I was reading your book that some of that real experience of geological time before knowing about these organisms, and that was the amazing thing to even find out about their existence. But I think where that really became clear to me was about 20 years ago, the first time I hiked down into the Grand Canyon. So when you go into sort of geological layers, and I remember the guy who guided us at the time sort of explained how we were sort of, as we were hiking down into the canyon, we were sort of going deeper into time. So how are these kinds of geological objects different from the biological objects that you focus on? And do they give us a different sense of deep time?
So there's a few different points to address. So I'll start with the idea of them being portraits. So in a sense, that's a combination of aesthetic choices, framing choices, but also a connection to the biology of these organisms. So as I said, I wanted to photograph individual organisms. So that was, again, a way, instead of just, for instance, photographing old species, so or primitive species, so liverworts and cycads, to me, it was important to choose things that had individual longevity, because as individuals, that's an easier entry point to connecting to a lifespan for us. The decision to think of them as portraits is, again, tied to this idea of these are individuals, and I want to make portraits. I don't want to make landscapes. So I didn't have time to share with you tonight. I have a whole body of work that's entitled The Only Paradise is Paradise Lost, and the aesthetics of that body of work are just completely different from oldest living things. I just had different parameters that I'd set up for myself. In terms of geologic time and geology, I think absolutely it's, that I grew to appreciate geology more through the process of learning about these ancient organisms. So, for instance, that image that I shared of South Georgia with the Hercules Bay with Medusa kelp, the geology of that place to me was finally understanding there is a whole story here. You just need to know how to read it. But to me, that's a different project because the idea of connecting to something that's alive and continuously living was the cornerstone of the project, that it had to be us as living things had to connect with something that's alive.
Because it connects to some desire for immortality?
I certainly think that's part of it. I mean, I think there's a desire to understand that kind of temporality a little bit more, to create. I mean, we all, who hasn't had an experience of awe, like looking up at the stars or walking amongst the giant sequoias? There's things that trigger that sense of awe. a lot of these organisms, you have to do a little bit more digging. So if you came across that lichen, you wouldn't be like, wow, this is amazing. It's 3,000 years old. You'd have no idea unless you had the scientific research. So it was important to weave those things together.
But you also mentioned with regard to the aretas that they're kind of like aliens.
Yes.
And that's the other reaction, right, that you could also say. And that's, I found myself, as a science fiction fan, I found myself sometimes being fascinated by these organisms, not because I could relate to them, but precisely because I couldn't. Mm. I cannot imagine what it's like to be alive for 3,000 years, 80,000 years.
Right. Well, get back to me next time, because I'm now an artist in residence with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial
Intelligence. Oh, wow. Yeah. So you'll be on the X-Files next. let me ask you, I wanted to get back to the species and individual issue in a minute, but just a couple of practical questions. So I noticed that in the some of the texts that accompanied the photos, you often pointed to difficulties in dating, say, these hollow trees. I mean, we probably all know that you can date trees by counting the rings. But a lot of these trees, it turned out, and that was fascinating for me to find out, are actually hollow. So you can't easily do that. And then you have things like bacteria, like seagrass, where how do you even date them, and how certain is the dating? How certain are the scientists about
that? It's a great question, and I'll just back up to the precursor to that question, which is, why wasn't this project done before in the sciences, looking at longevity across species? And it's precisely for that reason that all of these different things get dated in different ways, that there isn't an area of sciences that deals with longevity across species, because the way the sciences are set up, we're ever specializing. So if you study bacteria, you're not studying all bacteria, let alone your coral and seagrass and dendrochronology. So that was an interesting thing that I learned early on, that so instead of working with one scientist who would partner with me on the whole project, I worked with 30, which was fantastic. But then that also meant learning how of these different things are dated. So I always tried to begin with the published scientific research papers. So that means these are peer-reviewed papers. There's usually, you'll see that the numbers are 13,000 years or 12,000 years. It's not 12,027. Like, there definitely is a bit of leeway with these numbers. But like I was describing with the Tasmanian Lomatia and the radiocarbon dating, that's often the case where a radiocarbon date will set a minimum age for a particular organism, and it could be much older. I mean, this also goes to show how much chance is involved in this kind of research. So, you know, maybe if that researcher had walked around the other side of the shrub, there would have been an 80,000-year-old fossilized sample. We don't know. Likewise, you know, there's the Huon pine in Tasmania also. they took a sample of pollen at the bottom of a lake bed. So these aren't, I mean, could they have gone deeper? Could they have measured a different part of the lake? Possibly. But we know it's at least 10,500 years old.
And so how did you deal in the other thing that's really striking, I think, about the book is, so you chose, I think for reasons that you explained in the talk, you sort of set 2,000 years as your minimum. But then from there, it seems to go across a huge range of orders of magnitude. I mean, a 3,000-year-old organism is a whole different story than an 80,000-year-old one. An 80,000-year-old one is a totally different story from a half a million-year-old one, like these actinobacteria that you showed on one of your slides. So those are just orders of magnitude that are in themselves totally different. And 2,000 or 5,000 years, I think, is something that, you know, just because human history reaches that far back, I think we don't have any trouble imagining 13,000 years is still okay when you go to the La Brea tar pits and you go to the museum, you find, you know, saber-toothed tigers and sloths that are from that period. But beyond that, you enter a whole different order of imagination or failure of imagination.
Right.
So how did you deal with that when you were working with these organisms that have super, super different types of longevity?
I mean, it's certainly a challenge, but also something I found fascinating and tried to make sense of. I mean, that's sort of the beauty of spending 10 years working on a project like this, is constantly trying to create parameters for myself in which I could understand and relate to these timescales. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have a simple answer for it, but, you know, in part, there were the some of the things that I did in the book creating infographics. So, for instance, the timeline of the history of the universe, where there's some, you know, once you start to see, oh, 500,000 years ago was the first pre-human hut structure was found. I didn't know that. You know, so you start to create these different touchstones that start to form a story or a path towards something that looks like a more fleshed out picture. Likewise, I created a growth strategy chart that's looking at, well, what are the connections? Why are some why do we have this cluster of things that are between 2 and 5,000 years? And then another strange cluster around the 10 to 13,000 years. Some of these things I don't have answers to, but you start to see, then you look at things like geology and you look at things like, well, what was the last ice age? And the pieces of the puzzle start to come together. One of the biggest things that I realize, though, is that there's no way that I as an individual can complete this whole story. Mm-hmm. So the hope is that by sort of pulling out some of these tantalizing bits that people from any discipline can pick up and continue to create the picture.
Cool. Well, let me come back to what you just mentioned a few minutes ago, sort of this deliberate choice to focus on individuals rather than species. And if I understood you correctly, your reasoning for that was that people can relate more easily to one organism that is long-lived rather than to species. But I wonder whether that's true, because, I mean, we see in the contemporary concern over endangered species, you know, the enormous affection that a lot of people bring to bear on, say, polar bears. Yeah.
Sure.
People care very deeply about certain kinds of species. Now, they're not all species, and they tend to come from the vertebrates and mostly from the birds and the mammals and sometimes from amphibians, usually not from fishes, usually not plants, usually not mushrooms. But still, people care very, very deeply about species. So why is it so important to focus on individuals? And is that sort of a particularly Western inflection? Because, I mean, for example, in Japan or China, I mean, people think about their own longevity very typically in terms of their children and especially grandchildren, so in terms of the family, rather than just their own longevity. So
well,
what was it? Can you explain a little bit more about
course.
What's at stake there?
Yes, well, a few things. Well, it's interesting because the project really started in Japan through this tree that's right. Really this...
The Jobonsugiya.
Which... Everyone in Japan seemed to know Jomonsugi. There's this reverence and appreciation for this kind of longevity that I would say, if anything, that's lacking a little bit in Western culture and is maybe more pronounced in Eastern cultures. In terms of extinction, it's an interesting question, too, because in some ways you're just getting down to the last individuals. So you've got your Lonesome George, you've got, you know, your last of something, and we relate to like, oh, this one last frog is the only one of its kind.
But that's a very Western and it's a very historically specific kind of obsession. I mean, that's something we've inherited from the Romantic age, right? The early 19th century, that obsession with the dying, whose impending death gives them sort of greater beauty, greater value.
Well, so I'm suggesting connecting with the living. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying this is all tragic, I mean, there's obviously, it's quite clear that we are living in some dire times that I think certainly to everyone in this room, that's abundantly, right. It's just obvious and present. So by flipping around the narrative to say, well, we have these things that we can celebrate. And in some ways, in the same way that you use something like the polar bear to help defend an entire environment, entire ecosystem, the oldest living organisms can function in much the same way. So for instance, if you want to protect the environment that the spruce tree lives in, well, we're going to have to decrease global warming. So my hope is that collectively these organisms can help serve as a beacon of hope and also a wake-up call that they require that protection. They might not be as charismatic as a polar bear, but if we have some personal connection, then we're much more likely to care about their fate and therefore the entire environment and ecosystem of which they're part and of which we're part.
So in focusing on individuals like that, did you find that you were sometimes butting up against the limits of how to define an individual? Because, I mean, on one hand, you already have, I mean, even with something like us, right? I mean, by the time you're 50, it's probably not a single cell in your body that's still the same as when
a
you were born.
A couple brain cells, I checked.
Yeah, right, yeah. But not much,
not
right?
Much, and, not much,
and then here, I mean, it, you know, there were some cases that I found that really fascinating. I mean, there's some cases where you have a tree and that tree is sort of pretty recognizably the same over thousands of years. But then I was very struck by the picture of the aspen colony, which actually looked like very young trees to me, but it was actually a colony. And repeatedly you talked, and you mentioned in your talk, the these clonal colonies, where it's actually not so much one individual or its cells, but the genetic blueprint that's still there, right?
Well,
there, genetically.
Well, the way you can think about it, it is an individual, but in much the same way. I mean,
so what's an individual?
I'm going to mix a couple of things. So think of this more in the concept of individual and colony. Much the same way that you are you from the moment that you're born, and yet most of your cells are not the cells you were born with, the same is true with these clonal colonies. Genetically, nothing has changed from day one 80,000 years ago or 100,000 or 500,000 years ago. Genetically, still the same thing, and yet all of these changes have taken place in terms of growth. Some cells die, other cells are created. So to me, the idea of an individual was to include these unitary organisms like single trees and clonal colonies that are genetically the same. So in other words, anything that fit that criteria, that genetically from day one to year 100,000 to infinity is genetically the same. And again, that was my prerogative as an artist, to be able to decide to include these things together. And it's not that it isn't recognized scientifically, but rather you wouldn't normally look at these things together.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me ask you a couple of things also about just the way in which you put together different media in this book. And I already mentioned that. And the photos are completely striking, some of them. And then others, I was like, oh, there's almost nothing to see here. And you say at the beginning, I mean, like the underground forest where, you know, okay, but the major part of this organism is underground, right? And all you can photograph is this, you know, striking, but not extraordinary vegetation on the surface. And you said toward the beginning of your book, you said that you felt it was particularly poignant and apt in some ways that you capture the life of something that has this unimaginably long lifespan in something that really arrests one moment. And I found myself disagreeing with that. I thought, no, the photos are great, but I just look at the photos, say the map like in here, and I don't know that I'm looking at an old organism. I know that I'm looking at some kind of organism, but I don't actually, I mean, the full impact of what this is and how old this is, it's actually the photo cannot get that across. And it was actually your captions,
but
which interestingly were handwritten, and then your text.
That's part of the work. So that's,
no, of course. Yeah, but I mean, it seemed to me that it was actually the texts, the narratives that got the age across, not the photos.
I think it requires both, honestly. If you read a paper that says there's 3,000-year-old lichens, okay. You know, that's the point. The point is that it requires all of these different things. It requires the visual. So here's this image of the lichens, but it's also next to this rather primordial-looking landscape that's like, oh, right. So here's a little bit more context for that. The handwritten titles, which all have the name of the organism, the age and the location, and a catalog number, so it's the dates that I photographed them. And then when you see it in the context of the book, hopefully you'll read the chapter as well and then have that layer. I mean, I know you did. Some people just look at the pictures. But my hope is even if
you just look at the captions, the pictures, that you read the title.
Yeah. But one of the reasons also that I shared some of the exhibition installation photos was to show that if you're in a gallery space, you're going to see the photographs. It's handwritten on the prints. But you're not going to stand there and read the book in the gallery.
That's true, yeah. How do you handle that in the exhibits?
So
that's actually
in part, yeah. So I definitely have a sheet where you have a little bit of information to walk around with. But that's the reason why I put the taxonomy large on the wall and then paint on the wall the kingdoms and then have a separate room that's filled with scientific research papers and samples of things that I brought back and funny, strange things in my x-ray and, you know, some medications and travel books and all the other books I was reading, so environmental and philosophical and art books that I was reading, and 10 years of sketchbooks, my notebooks as well. So so your point is actually well made that it requires all, it's meant to be seen as a whole with all of these components together. Because no one thing encapsulates all of this. How could it? And in part, that's about the nature of the project in general, that it's transdisciplinary. It's truly meant to take an idea across all of the different things that would normally be siloed off and instead say, how do we connect these? Because we are transdisciplinary organisms.
Right. Yeah. Just to come back, just for a quick follow-up question on this, on the portrait. So portraits usually are of people, you know, over the last few decades, people have often made a point of doing portraits of primates or of birds, so as to get across that a lot of animals also have very individual biographies and have individual memories. And in the case of, for example, portraits of chimps who were used in labs, that they also have a history of violence and suffering, that much of which they remember, and that has formed them. What's at stake in doing portraits of these things that have no faces? How does that change the nature of photographic portraiture?
I mean, by calling images of plants and inanimate animals like coral, by calling them portraits, what I'm really trying to do is draw attention to the idea that these are individuals. The ways that you can see the impact of the things they've suffered are different. Certainly you can see, you know, names scratched into the bark of the baobab trees. You can see different ways that these the brain coral, for instance, has places where it was attacked by a school of fish. So you can see the ways that these different individuals have suffered, but that's quite a different thing from lab animals. Yeah.
So what were you, when you were, making the photos and writing the texts, what to you were the most difficult moments in either making the photos or writing the text? I mean, where did you feel that you were sort of hitting limits, or what were the hardest moments, and how did you sort of get over them so as to get to the final?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because in some ways there were a lot, and in some ways, well, I just did it. So, I mean, there were different things along the way that felt like huge challenges.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And they varied. So things like overcoming my fear of deep water to scuba dive versus talking to the Tasmanian government to get access, which took months and
red tape.
Or, you know, the difficulty of getting lost in Greenland, or the 2 years that it took to get access to go to Antarctica. So along the way, there were so many different things. But the thing that's the beauty about doing that kind of work is that it just creates a reason. I wasn't not going to do it. So I wasn't taking no for an answer. So in some ways, that was the answer. You just persevere.
Were there also moments when you just were, okay, so you were there, you were in front of the tree or in front of the lichen, and you were there with your camera, and you find yourself wondering, well, now how do I photograph this? I mean, what kind of zoom? Mm. What kind of distance? Do I do this in black and white? Do I do it in color? Do I do it? I mean, a couple of times you had photos from above. Mm. How far away do I want to position myself? And so forth. Did you find yourself wondering about these things, and where did they?
Yeah, and I would say that's part of my creative process, regardless of what I'm doing. So, I mean, within one instance, I chartered a plane, so then I knew I was taking aerial shots, but that's quite a lot of planning. And then sometimes you get to these things, and just as you said, like the lichens, you wouldn't know that they're that. They're so diminutive, and you're like, wow, I'm on the other side of the world backpacking, and it's really uncomfortable, and what am I going to do to show that this thing has this, you know, incredible story behind it? So there were certainly many moments of how am I going to do justice to this idea? And I think that's the hardest thing for, and really for any creative person and people in all sorts of disciplines. Like I know I'm on the right path, but I don't know if I can bring this to life in the way that I want it to. And that's, you know, it's also sitting writing the book as well. After spending, you know, all these years out in the field, and then, you know, I had this cycle basically where I do some research, do some travel planning, you know, make all my connections, go photograph, come back, do a little editing. But it was quite different to come back, sit down at a desk in my studio and say, okay, now I have to edit these, I don't know, 10 or 15,000 images down to 125.
Yeah,
and now I have to write 30 essays that encapsulate a decade's worth of work across all of these different ideas that I've been thinking about for all this time. So it was, yeah, it was hard.
But I found it really interesting that you chose really, really different strategies for some of these organisms to suggest sort of that relation between sort of geological time spans and biological lifespans. Like in the one picture that you showed of the moss, where actually, the moss is really hard to see, and if you didn't point it out, mostly what you would see is the water and the rock.
Yeah.
Whereas you have one other shot that I think was not in the PowerPoint slide, but that's a beautiful shot. That's just a zoomed in close up of a tree root that where the bark has folds that look geological. Mm-hmm. I mean, it almost looks like rock that's been pushed together by geological forces. So totally different. I mean, it's not the far away view, but the close up actually that conveys the geological
sense.
It's
a really good point. I mean, my dream is to show up at these, find these organisms for one thing, just to find them sometimes. So it's a coup in and of itself, but to find it and then find like, oh, it's so poetic. I know exactly how to make beautiful photographs of this. Sometimes that happened and sometimes that didn't.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the nature of the work as well. Like I wasn't waiting for some heroic beam of light to, you know, shine down through the clouds. You know, sometimes I had 15 minutes to photograph something.
Yeah.
So, you know, the reality of it was, you know, there were constraints. But in part, I wanted to also show, you know, this is the reality of these organisms. So some of them are photogenic, some of them truly aren't. And some of them I caught on a good hair day, and others, not so much.
We're almost at the point where we should open up to the audience, but let me conclude by asking you about one aspect of the book that we haven't yet talked about, and that I, as somebody who's passionate about writing, are particularly interested in. I mean, one organism that we haven't so much talked about, and that's you. This is also in the essays. This is really sort of a travel diary. It's travel writing. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk about what you see as the relationship between what you went there to see, the things that you were sort of questing for, that you really wanted to, and sometimes at considerable expense of time and money, effort, getting through red tape, sometimes suffering injuries, having to be, you know, taken back in an ambulance to a hospital and things like that, overcoming fears. There's clearly a lot of your life and your emotion, and also just your practicalities, your finances, your time, your physical energy that went into these journeys. And that sort of was part of what was really fascinating about it. Then you also occasionally and very intriguingly put in little bits like, oh, you know, relationship with boyfriend is really going downhill while we're, you know, traveling around the Mediterranean. At one point, you say that you actually went to this one tree with just tears streaming down your face because you had just broken up or were about to break up with your boyfriend. What's the relationship between your personal narrative there and the narrative that you tell, the story that you tell of these extremely long-lived organisms? How does the organism you know, relate to the Welwitschia and the...
I mean, I'm not sure if I have a pithy answer to that question, but, you know, I realized through, as I sat down and started writing, I mean, I also had been blogging a bit along the way, so not, I didn't start blogging at the beginning of the project, but I did, I think when I went to Africa, that's when I started blogging, and it dawned on me, as I'd gone through the years doing this work, that I'd sort of written myself out of my own story, and I paused and thought, why is that? Because I'm talking about personal connection and entry points. And I'm talking about things that I've observed. And it became clear to me that I wanted to weave those things in. So sometimes they were very personal things, like going through this really difficult moment in a relationship. But for me, that framed my experience of visiting this 3,000-year-old olive tree and thinking about resilience, thinking about, then I talk about the idea of wounds. So that particular tree is still used to create the olive wreaths for the Olympians. And so when you cut the branches of trees, what's left there is something called a wound. And so I was thinking about wounds, personal wounds as individuals, the wounds of each tree that's also connected to this beautiful thing and with historical and current relevance. And that, to me, that was a really important, interesting way to show this the interconnectedness I keep talking about. And it seemed vital not to write myself out of my own story.
Got it. Well, let's open it up. Thank you, Rachel. Please, go ahead.
Hi, I just had a question about the photography side of it. So you shot medium format, which seems to lend itself really well to classic portraiture, and you had mentioned shooting film. I wanted to know how you chose the medium that you did. Is it about intimacy with film or chemistry, or what parts of it fascinated you and really put you in contact with this subject?
Well, so first of all, in 2004, a lot of people still shot film. It was not weird. but you saw a little bit of the installation shots from my exhibition. I make very large prints, so they're 44 by 54-inch prints. The quality that you need to make prints at that size is still much better in film than it is in digital, unless you're, you know, have a $30,000 or $40,000 digital camera, which I do not and don't feel like I need. The film was doing exactly what I needed it to do. Also, that particular camera is a rangefinder, so it looks like a big 35 millimeter, and it was perfect for lugging all over the world. I literally took that camera to every continent, which wouldn't have really been possible with a 4x5, so sheet film, so certainly that would have other aesthetic qualities to it. But to me, that was it was the obvious choice that met all of my needs.
Thank you for that talk. This is a two-parter that has to do with global warming. I think you kind of answered the first part. What is it about these systems that can survive for 20,000, 40,000 years or so forth? And I hope this part doesn't sound rude, but the tree in Sweden, you said it's grown faster in the last 50 years. So what? What is it about that tree? I mean, I see it as a good thing. We have more wood.
Well, you've been recorded here, so they'll know if you go and chop down that tree, you're going to be in trouble. So, I mean, it was actually interesting. Ursula brought up something about older trees being hollowed out, and there's some... So I'm going to bounce around to a few different parts of this question. It's not so much these systems necessarily that I'm talking about individuals that have survived a long time. Usually there's some anomaly that's happened that's allowed them to survive that long. So for instance, there's one of the Alerce trees in Chile that's similar to the redwoods and giant sequoias. Most of those were deforested for the lumber industry. But there's one that I photographed that just has this bite taken out of it with a saw because they started sawing it down and saw that it was hollow in the middle. And so it was left standing. It wasn't worth it to fell this giant tree. And so now it's one of the oldest living Alerce trees, precisely because it did have a flaw. So that's just an interesting thing. Likewise, the Tasmanian Lomatia I mentioned a few times, that one has is not able to, it has an anomaly, it's a triploid, so it's not able to reproduce sexually even if there was another one of its kind. So there's this strange sort of, I think there's a way to connect with this narrative, like what is it about this shrub that wants, of course I'm just putting human attributes on it, that wants to survive against all odds. And there's something that's really poetic and heroic about that, and I think that's just, again, a way to connect with these ideas. In terms of the spruce tree and the importance of that image, I come back to that because it's a way to visualize the impact that we're having. So you could say that that particular tree, so what? But if you think about what global warming is doing, what climate change is doing on a global scale, it's wreaking havoc and will only be doing more of the same and worse as time goes on. So to create something that we can actually visualize in 50 years, we know what 50 years is. You know, holy shit, like it's happening. So it's meant to be, in a sense, a barometer. It's meant to tell you, hey, things are changing and we should pay attention to them.
But you bring up a really, I think that's a really important distinction, that on one hand you have resilience as something that is sort of an inbuilt, hardwired ability to live through adversities, climate change, parasites, so forth, and the other kind of survival that is just pure contingency. So it was just like, okay, that organism was lucky when all the other ones, or most right. of the other ones of its species were not, and it doesn't really have anything to do with its inherent resilience, right? I mean, was that what you were... what you were pointing at? I think that's actually a really interesting distinction between some of these cases.
Thanks so much for the talk. What I really loved, the sense that you are honoring these individuals in and of themselves. And we talked a lot about points of connection for, you know, us to relate and get a sense of time and global warming and, but for you, is that like a big part of why you were doing this? And like, was there a feeling that you got in the presence of these old organisms that you could describe? Or was there one in particular? Or?
You know, I knew, you know, as I described a little bit when I was getting the idea for the project, I knew I wanted to do an art and science project. And I'd gotten a number of ideas and discarded them because they didn't feel substantive to me. So it was important to me that whatever work I was going to do connected with something on a deeper level for me. So in the environmental aspect is not something that was tagged on. That was something that was deeply, I mean, not that you're saying that, but just that was deeply important to me. And I hadn't really thought, like, I'm going to do an environmental project. But it became clear that these things are connected in this way that made sense. So when I got the idea, I was like, yes, that's the idea, because it combines all these different ways of thinking. And time has become more and more important to me over time. So my work now is about time and space. I definitely would say I had a sense of reverence for, you know, these organisms. I spent, in part, spending so much time researching and then finally getting to them. I mean, some were easy to get to, some were so hard. So, like, seeing the moss on the slope of that, of Elephant Island, I mean, the chances of me being able to get there and find it, I mean, it was just, and connecting also to the Shackleton story I was telling you a little bit about, I mean, that to me was incredibly poignant. Like, so, but it sneaks up on you too. So, you know, sometimes it's landscape. Sometimes it was a landscape that's like, oh, or like catching fish with your bare hands in Greenland. Like, oh, that is a window into deep time. That is this moment of seeing what the earth was like before it was overrun with humans. So it was certainly not always what I expected, but hopefully I was able to convey that both in the book and in the work.
Rachel and Ursula, we're out of time. I want to thank you for your questions and for your vision and for all of you for being such a great audience. Thank you so much.
That was great. That was really fun.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.